Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
I kind of like embracing the awkwardness, right? Of because that feels authentic to me, right? And I was like, we gotta replicate that. So I should be sure to start the next episode off with something awkward. And then it occurred to me that the idea of like intentionally manufacturing awkwardness was the silliest thing I could have thought of, because it happens completely by accident in every single one of my other conversations I've ever had. So I don't have like any way that you should respond to this prompt, but I just wanted to start us off with that thought.
Well, I've got one for you. I'll build off it if it's okay.
Sure, yeah.
Having been a beneficiary of your conversation with John, I thoroughly enjoyed the awkward intro, and I agree with you. It was completely authentic because you couldn't have scripted it. That's what made it funny, and that's what made it inviting to wanna to sort of track or pay attention to. And it reminds me of some research that's come out recently about facilitation, and specifically about what leaders can do to create the psychological space for new thinking to happen inside of a meeting. And one of the tactics or techniques that leaders, or whether they're leader in title or sort of informal leaders, can deploy is to simply kick off the meeting by telling an embarrassing story about themselves. And by doing so, it creates the space of like, well, okay, if the person that we're supposed to think of as being a leader can tell an embarrassing story, then it's okay to screw up, or it's okay to experiment, it's okay to try things out in this meeting. It's safe here, right? And a funny thing happens if you actually play this out, is that if the leader starts doing it, other people will build on that as well. And you can see other people tell embarrassing stories, and it just has the snowball effect, which then creates the right kind of energy you're trying to manufacture in the room to really, I think, set the stage for a good ideation session. So I say bring on the awkward, lean into the silly ideas that you have, because that's the best way you can start a session.
Yeah, Nate, were you in this class that we had with the SEALs where one guy said that he had a criminal record in high school?
Absolutely.
And then around the room, every single person had like a law story. Like either they got arrested or they almost got arrested.
It turned into a game, a one-upsmanship kind of a situation, where people were telling the most sort of extraordinary or fantastical aspect of their biographical history you could think of, instead of people just giving you the basics like, here I am, this is my job, this is my identity kind of thing. That one person set the tone. You're absolutely right.
That's such a fantastic insight. There was one caveat to that start with an embarrassing story thing, which I've seen some leaders do, which is when they use it as an opportunity for a humble brag. It's like, I have the most embarrassing story ever. And then they're like, I was having my weekly lunch with Reagan, and and this horribly embarrassing thing happened. I'm sorry. That's not the point of that story.
And the caviar dripped onto my tie.
Yeah, exactly. That reminds me a lot of the role of the icebreakers in facilitated sessions, and I've heard some pushback on use of icebreakers, that people aren't getting the point of it. I recently started doing one where I ask people to identify with what their favorite animal is, like what's their spirit animal, and then they post on the board, this is my animal. And then I kind of expanded it to, all right, now everybody group your animals, put them into their categories, just because I wanted to see what people did by themselves. And it was one of those things that I was kind of anticipating to go badly. I was just sort of curious how it would go badly. And it was an opportunity to say, hey, this is what happens when we don't apply purposeful social technology. when we don't think about how we're going to group things, or the fact that we will all automatically think something different when we think categories of animals, right? It starts with something silly though, right? As it's like, because it brings us all to the level of human beings engaging with each other, which I think is an important aspect.
Quick thought on the icebreaker thing. I think anytime, you know, if you feel like you might get pushback, something you can tuck in your back pocket, it's just simply throw out the sort of analogous scenario of, can you think of a professional sports team that would ever play a game without warming up? Absolutely not, right? So when you talk to, or if you work in a high-speed creative team, IDEO, and you know, I mean, you pick the high-level design firm, right, or a high-level creative problem-solving think tank, they all do cognitive warm-ups the same way that a sports team would do physical warm-ups, right? It's about literally kind of getting the blood flowing and sort of the imagination muscles working. So if the pros are doing it, then I don't think it's ever too good. We're too good to be doing it too. You know what I mean?
This seems like a great timing in the podcast episode to say welcome to In the Weeds with Project Agitare, or now Agitare, because that's our rebrand recently. We dropped the project part.
No longer the Facebook. It's just
exactly.
Facebook.
And also to say, we should probably have you both introduce yourselves just really briefly, who you are, what you're, and then a just very quick, let's say under 60 seconds, your journey into the world of design, which I think will apply the amount of constraint it requires for you to really prioritize what you think is the most, you know, the juiciest aspects of your role and what it means to you professionally and personally. You want to start, Nate?
Sure. First thing, because I'm not sure whether I'm here as a sort of private citizen or as a contractor for Meta Solutions working under the Joint Special Operations University, the educational arm at SOCOM. And if so, all opinions are certainly my own. That being said, my foray or sort of launch into this field came through, it was emergence, it was happenstance. And I just happened to be really fortunate to end up in a place where there was a small group of sort of thoughtfully committed practitioners of applied creativity at SUNY Buffalo State. The department was known as the Center for Studies in Creativity, which then became known as the International Center for Studies in Creativity, and is now currently, as of last year, I think now called the Center for Applied Imagination, which is a hat tip to a book written in 1953 by Alex Osborne, published by Scribner, called Applied Imagination, which laid out the original principles and foundation for brainstorming, and actually coined the term brainstorming. And, you know, it was written in 1953, so it's going a while back, but I just went back and reread it, and I still cannot believe how far ahead of its time that book is in terms of laying out best practices. So anytime you see design thinking principles etched into the walls at IDEO, or you, like I said, you pick the big name design firm, those all emanate from, those almost all, I will say, I'm not taking away contributions that have happened since, but largely the foundations are coming from that early work of, you know, it's the 1949 address to the American Psychological Association by J.P. Guilford. It's 1961 Graham Wallace laying, or I'm sorry, 1926 Graham Wallace laying out his four-stage model. It's 1961 Mel Rhodes writing a paper that documented the four P's of creativity in terms of the creative people, creative process, creative products, and creative press or creative environments. It's this foundational work. I think you've got to have that backstory there, which is in a, you know, I'm over on my 60 seconds, but that's where how I came into this game was by being a creativity researcher and then an applied practitioner of those insights about the foundations of creativity and how you can bring them to life in a group setting applied against real world problems.
It's so funny that you bring up that origin, and you mentioned just like the 1950s and some of those foundational works, is because somebody just posted on our Slack channel an essay by Isaac Asimov in 1959 about the nature of creativity and the facilitation required, which I was blown away because I'm seeing some stuff that we're still wrestling with today. We're trying to bring just this simple concept of what is the role of the facilitator and what are the very simple things that they're trying to foster within, you know, a time and space to help people be more creative. So it's interesting that this science has been around and this practice has been around for such a long time. And we're still, it seems like we're still kind of struggling with it to maybe get it out of the realm of the academic and into the hands of the practitioner and make sure that those, I mean, I think that always with academic circles and practitioner circles, there's a disconnect that seems like a pretty common problem across disciplines. But it's one that I definitely see in this realm.
I have a hunch on why, but we should let Ben say hi first.
Sure. Yeah. Ben?
Hi, I'm Ben. I get to say I'm Dr. Ben Zweibelson now because I just got to defend my dissertation with Lancaster. So that's exciting. Wow. For me. So
here.
Thank you. And so my research in philosophy was essentially the philosophy of design. So a focus on military design, but at a meta level, explaining how design works, both from the commercial, academic, security side, and then kind of talking about all these things, which is part of why I teach at the Joint Special Operations University. And just like Nate, I'm also a contractor. So all my comments here are, of course, my own. I started off as an oil painter, and then I realized I couldn't pay for college. And so I joined the Connecticut Army National Guard. And 22 years later, I finished my time in the Army Infantry. And so along the way, I went to this school called the School U.S. Army School of Advanced Military Studies, or SAMS. And so SAMS is kind of the benchmark for the intellectual center for planning and strategy and all these things, but they were teaching design for a little while. And for a very brief period, they had Dr. Shmuel Nave, the Israeli general who started the first military design methodology. And so he was teaching there at SAMS for a couple of years, and I got lucky to catch the very tail end of that. And then there was an institutional backlash, and we can talk about this maybe later, about why institutions fight these types of radical ideas. But I got lucky enough to get a good dose, and ever since then, I've been chasing and trying to consume more and more of this design thing. And I hold a lot of controversial positions, to include that there is designing for commerce, which is what a majority of your audience are probably more familiar with. Those are user products, user experiences, and so forth. And there's a lot of great design methodologies for that. Then there's designing for war. And the two of them overlap. They interplay, but they're not interchangeable. You should not walk into a IBM and try to apply a military design method without some sort of transition or bridging, nor should you go into a military organization and say, here's your solution for Syria. Use the hexagonal IDO model. Use Agile. Use Scrum. These things won't work except for very specific areas. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I know this is over 60 seconds and not part of my intro, so I'll just stop.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When I said 60 seconds, I definitely anticipated it's, you know, it's kind of like people say when your doctor asks you a question, assume they're going to multiply what your answer is by three because they know you're lying. Sometimes yeah. When you apply constraints, you should take, you know, what people are going to anticipate is really possible and in the moment into those constraints, right? Which is why we make them somewhat flexible. I don't think that I've ever really stuck perfectly to a time limit when I do like an exercise. Maybe other people do, but I usually am like, let people freak out, see what happens when they're panicking in those last moments. Maybe they'll start generating a bunch more in the final 2 seconds. Let them go longer. So yeah.
Sessions run on facilitator time. Facilitator time is magical. It can sort of it can bend in either direction you need it to, right?
Yeah, I like that. Maybe the seconds just get longer, right? I said seconds. You were assuming that they were all, you know, going to be the same length, but maybe they're not. That reminds me of a thing that I'm reading this book by Daniel Stillman about designing conversations. And he talks about how one of the problems with the way that we approach most social technologies or most conversations is that we go into it playing the same rules as the games we were playing before. And we don't acknowledge that we could be playing the rules, changing the rules. And one of the things he said that I loved was, you know, we tend to play Scrabble where we all have our tiles and the other people have their tiles. But what if we pooled our tiles together and saw what words we could make and just played for maximum points? And I'm going to like dig into that more because I love the idea of I love the idea of that analogy where we tend to be in competition mode, but I feel like design in a lot of ways puts us in, takes us out of that natural competitive mode. Is that something that you feel like is a fair statement?
There's a psychological lever I like to use, and we can think about it as project envy, in the sense that I love celebrating the work of small groups, because especially working in the special operations community, everybody wants to do well. You're dealing with like the high end, get after it type folks, right? Like they self-selected to be within SOF. Everyone wants to do better than each other, but at the same time, they're not competing directly. There is space for co-opetition, a blending of cooperation and competition, right? So there's this natural, and the same phenomenon showed up in what Ben had referred to earlier in terms of that guy who had told the story about his misdeeds in the past, right? Like this one-upsmanship occurs and it's like, oh, did you see that creative technique that team used? Now we're going to take Play-Doh, wrap it around the edge of our whiteboard. So now we have this extra dimension of storytelling capacity that we didn't have before, right? So we're going to build off of. It's a series of leaps that are happening through intellectual and through multimedia, right?
I would add that there's a great example we can give here just on the nuts and bolts of the facilitation. And Nate was the one who really brought this into our program. We call it the puzzle exercise. And there's a whole bunch of things that are going on, but essentially, and I'm going to summarize it very quickly, the students and design teams are told that they have a certain amount of time and that they're going to have to assemble a puzzle. And they're supposed to come up with their plan before they're given the said puzzle. And so most everybody, they see a photo and it's a misleading image of what this puzzle is going to be. And so, of course, their initial plans are wrong. I mean, they're almost always wrong. And what we're really looking at is when we drop the bag and tell them go, the environment is competitive. So everyone, that you have all these military, you've got a bunch of Navy SEALs, you've got some Green Berets in there, you've got all these special operations people, and they want to win. And this is usually the second day. So they're like, oh, we got to win this. And we watch to see what happens. And so the surprise, the aha, is that on the back of the puzzle are numbers. And if you can choose to assemble the puzzle right side up, like 99.99% of us have always followed those rules, like you said, yeah. Dan. But what if we assemble the puzzle upside down? And then bridging off of that, we have seen teams try to trade pieces or steal pieces from other teams. They have looked at what other teams are doing. They've done all these things. And teams that assemble the puzzle and they feel they've won, then they go, wait a minute, the puzzle's upside down. And we need to put it right side up because they're following an old rule. So we never said that. And so they'll do things like take desks and slam them on top of each other and try to flip them over and do all these weird things. And it's just absolute chaos to the end. So I'll pause here because I know Nate's probably got a lot of observations he can throw from the facilitator side on what we really see happening here that goes back into these themes.
Sure. There's a couple key ingredients to this. One is, and Ben alluded to this, but giving each team assigning a leader or letting them self-identify a leader who then takes the tasker and relays it back to their team. So they're given instructions where they have 2 minutes to generate a strategy or a plan to assemble this puzzle in the least amount of time possible. And at this point in the game, all they're given is a photocopy of the box top of the puzzle. So they go back to their teams and they, for 2 minutes, talk about distribution of labor, division of labor, et cetera, right? Like, how are we going to work as a team in order to assemble this puzzle in the least amount of time possible, right? And as Ben said, it's funny when we drop the bags of puzzle pieces on the tables because the muscle memory kicks in. And I think that's really what you're up against, Dan, when you're describing these sort of ingrained patterns of thinking, especially, and they manifest even more intensely, I think, in a competitive environment. And we actually manufacture, in addition to the people sort of already having this competitive bent to it, to them internally, but that environment in the teams or in the room, as well as the soundtrack that we put on of some like slightly anxiety inducing building tempo music in the background with like clinking and banging like plates from like a cafe scene, right? And it's so funny because the people, when we debrief this at the end, they'll say we never even heard the music, but they felt it, right? Like their heart rate is accelerated, et cetera. And it's fascinating because there are a lot of teams that'll never even notice the data on the back of the puzzle pieces. They will flip every piece over to get it picture side up to make reality map to what they wanted to see, as opposed to being open to the newer novel information that's there. And if they're open to the novel information, one person, it requires one person to call time out in the group, whether they have, they're the leader or not. Somebody's got to say, wait a minute, do you guys see the handwritten freaking numbers with arrows on the back of these puzzle pieces? Why are these here? There's no puzzle comes from the store that has magic marker written on the back of it with arrows, right? So I love the attentional blindness that's there as well. So there's so many ways to debrief this exercise, but I'll end on one more thing, and that Ben brings up an awesome point in that even after assembly is complete, there will be teams. Somebody has the inclination to ask that beautiful question. They say, well, wait a minute, how are we going to flip it over? So at that moment in time, this question's introduced into the group, and now the collective imagination of those teammates is now pointed against the challenge of, okay, well, we have to flip it over to be successful, because every puzzle we've ever seen before has been face up, right? Picture up. So if that's the framing you've put on the challenge, now Ben's right. They're going to start scanning the room looking for all the tools they might come up with in order to flip the puzzle over. And we've seen really wild stuff, you know, flip charts on top of each other, the stack decks, the one row at a time, tape using it to stick it together and flip it and all this stuff. But again, all up against the time pressure, because these other teams are moving just as quickly, and we're there in the background being like, oh, it's going to be really close. Like, I wonder who's going to get it, right? So we're playing into it. But at the same time, you know, there's a space there. There's a little intellectual wiggle room for somebody to say, well, wait a minute. They never said it had to be face up, right? The language we used was only assembly. That was the criteria, right? So just because we're used to seeing completed puzzles as being face up towards us, in no way implies that the only way we can win this game is to make it look like the way we've historically looked at it, right? So there's this opportunity to challenge the core assumption of what success looks like. And we use this as a key debrief point to say, well, wait a minute. I think in emerging operating environments, or if you want to suggest that, you know, sort of the nature or character of warfare changes over time, et cetera, we need to be able to fundamentally reimagine what success looks like in a variety of different contexts over and over and over again. And this requires being able to identify and challenge those core assumptions that are baked into the game, literally baked in, right? And it just requires us to be a little bit more deliberate and sort of thoughtful with the way that we're playing. Because if not, you end up just running off muscle memory.
Well, that reminds me a lot of the conversations that we've been having in the wake of COVID-19 and the, you know, sudden loss of operations, and now the stand up of virtual operations and the common practice of just doing exactly what we were doing before, but in a virtual kind of way. We're still doing, and which doesn't work very well. It doesn't produce the same kind of value, right? So those old social technologies were created to be efficient and repeatable with set roles and set activities and set timelines for the old rules, which we assumed would never change. Now the rules have changed. We didn't actually understand the value we were intending to create to start with. And so we're just trying to mimic the old factory processes for conveying a batch of information up, you know, in these set, you know, types of packets. And right now the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum is working through a project called X Work, where they're trying to figure out what are the new rules of work, which it seems like is what being an agile organization is all about, right? It's all about kind of understanding what the value to be created is, and then continually allowing the rules of work to change in order to facilitate or foster that value, like just to be very general about it. So one of the things that, you know, that puzzle exercise makes me think of is this idea of, first, you know, we self-organize into teams thinking that like there's this hierarchy that we have to set up first, right? Because that's what's supposed to work for problem solving, or has worked in the past, or we were taught to in whatever PME. And then there's the trying to anticipate everything instead of creating a structure that is all about first asking as many of the questions as possible, right? Which is one of the key points to what you guys are trying to do at JSAO, is to instill a mindset, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things, going back to the puzzle exercise, we don't see this every time, but we, our facilitators are waiting to watch. And it's the, there's a moment when they have their plan, the bag of puzzle pieces are dropped, and they slowly realize that most or all of their plan is not going to work. For example, most of them assume that the puzzle is square in their planning because Nate frames it that way. And so they, they usually come up with a plan like, you do the edges and I'll do this, and you, and they've got it all set up, and suddenly their entire plan isn't going to work. And as they're, as this is happening, you can see the wheels turning, and sometimes someone will come up with a new solution right there that deviates from the plan. And one of two things will happen. Either the team will agree to it and they'll shift their plan, or one or more people will say, no, stick to the plan, and they'll try to force it. And so we use that, and we key in on it. And so the facilitators move right over like a shark pit. And we're just watching and watching and watching, because usually the teams that stick to their original plan fail. They finish last. They don't do well. And then the whole part of the unpackaging is talking to them. And you talk to the, you ask the person who came up with the new idea, and then you say, what happened? Talk me through it. And then suddenly everyone's starting to really think about it. And then the people that were saying, no, stick to the plan, we say, okay, you recognize that wasn't a good thing, but why? Like, why did you feel compelled to do that? And the rest of the group, why did you all follow through? You know, and it gets into not bad decisions. We're not talking about individual decisions here. This is about the institutional forcing functions that generate us to do the same things over and over without us ever thinking about why we think. And that's the hardest part about design, is getting people to think about their thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe that speaks to, honestly, Nate, you said earlier you had a theory on the disconnect between the academic and the practitioner side of this. But what Ben just said makes me think that maybe a significant part of that is that these are a very large amount of the space in this world is heavily rooted in the theory of it. And so significant work has to be done in the realm of theory, because the biggest thing that you have to impart on people isn't the individual exercises, right? It's these meta concepts. And what are you trying to do theoretically or dynamically with information and social exchanges and stuff? I'm curious what you were going to say about the disconnect between the academic and the practitioner aspects of design are.
Yeah, I think on the one hand, when you think about creativity and design, we want to use those two constructs. They're just so big, and they mean so many different things to different kinds of people, that it doesn't really help to try to have a conversation about it at a 30,000 foot level, because no one's tracking the same thing, right? Like, an artist thinks about artistic creativity way differently than an engineer thinks about problem-solving creativity versus a scientist and scientific creativity, right? Like, I remember I was asked to do the keynote at an accounting conference, like this week-long continuing education for people who have their CPAs. They have this like mandatory annual requirement, right? So they knock out all their CEUs in one fell swoop in this week-long conference, and like the sleepiest Friday afternoon speaking billet was given to me when I was a junior academic teaching in the business school, right? And they wanted me to do a presentation on creativity. And I said, yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to, right? Room full of 500 or 600 people. I was trying to hone my speaking chops at the time. So I'm like, yeah, I'd love to do this. And I thought it was so funny because this group was emailing me 5 months out wanting my slides. And I'm like, you are out of your mind if you think I'm going to build a deck for you 5 months before this conference. You know, like, that's just not how I operate, right? Like, it's just, like, I think up the lecture we're going to do that day in class sometimes while I'm driving into class that day, right? Like, but they kept emailing me, right? And it's like typical, accountant behavior, stereotypical accountant behavior, right? But they wanted it ahead of time. They wanted it. They wanted it. They wanted it. So I finally broke down over Christmas break that semester, and I built them the slide deck. And I submitted it one night, and within like 60 seconds, I got an email back saying that it wasn't going to work. And I remember being so miffed by this. I'm like, they couldn't have even looked at all the slides. And they're like, I looked a little bit further down the email and it says, you're going to have to change the title of your presentation. And it said, because it was called Creativity in Accounting. And they said, that's what gets people in federal prison. And I said, oh, wow. Okay, I see what I'm up against now, right? Like, they have in their mind a very specific definition of what creativity is, and it's a bad thing. Yet I'm going to convince them that I'm going to leverage the research that's out there. I'm going to do some qualitative research on my own, sort of primary research, interviewing accountants and learning more about the practice of accountancy. And I'm going to analyze and develop case studies to specifically and deliberately identify the ways in which people manifest creativity in a professional accounting setting. And it turns out, not only are accountants creative, they're fantastically creative. And very specifically, I found this wonderful example in tax accountancy. So if you think about a tax accountant, what this person has to do from a work perspective, right? So like you want to circle this back to, you know, the new ways of working. Tax accountants have to analyze the IRS tax code, which gets updated regularly, like throughout the year. So they have to know the rules of the game, right? They have to learn how to put puzzles together based off this sort of amorphous, ever-evolving set of rules. And once they identify a loophole or like a little bit of white space on the board, they then have to develop a strategy to exploit that white space in the tax code. Once they've developed that strategy, they then have to go to their high net worth individual clients and convince them or pitch them on this strategy, time sensitive, by the way, to exploit this game that they think they've found space in the game for, right? They want to call this play and try to get a return on investment. Yeah. So if they can convince their clients to move money in these ways, to then generate a return on that investment before the IRS closes that loophole or changes the rules of the game again, right? So this cycle happens maybe every 4 months, 6 months, 8 months. And if you think about it, that's competitive with like the most high-end electronics product development cycles in the world, right? Like 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, right? So here we have this subset of accountants who are engaged in creative problem solving at a very high level on a regular basis, very high stakes, high pressure kind of a game, right? So I started laying out all these examples, and at the end of it, I had a whole bunch of accountants coming up to me saying, I'm so happy that I stayed around for this session on Friday afternoon because I finally feel like it's okay to be creative now or to think of myself as being creative because I'm always told that we're the people who say no, we're the reason why people can't do things, right? And that was a really, that stuck with me. That was really powerful. Feedback to have gotten.
So I'd like to throw in a few thoughts on going back to your original question as well on this. You know, you hear about the ivory tower, the academics, the theorists versus, you know, the doers, those in the trenches. And I think that sometimes it's an unhealthy dichotomy. It's sometimes even a false one. So one way of thinking about this is that, yes, it's true. If you're in an ivory tower, and you're just mindfully theorizing, but you're not applying it, it becomes ivory tower masturbation. And you never apply these new ideas, which makes it extremely hard to convince your organization to experiment, to try different things. At the same time, at the trench level, you've got your doers, you've got your door kickers, and this is where you have military doctrine. In the civilian world, this is where you have company manuals and smart books and nice posters that say synergy. And things like this. This stuff doesn't really work either unless it's absolutely simplistic or immediate, where certain things that don't need to be thought about are just done in rote memorization. So that becomes mindless practice. It means the organization can never really change. And what they end up doing is firing individuals and replacing them with somebody else and saying, do it again and be successful this time, but follow the same rule books. Right. Yeah. So in the middle between here is what is a foundational to military design at JSAL, but also I think across the entire military design movement, as well as in quite a bit of non-military design. And that's Donald Shun was a theorist who created reflective practice. And what Shun was talking about is a reflective practitioner is one who is practicing and mindful of what they have done, what they are currently doing and why, which means that they are operating between the two. It's the ivory tower in the trench and back and forth. It's an endless infinity loop. And what I think design provides beyond that in military, it's military planning, but in the civilian sectors, it's going to be just your traditional corporate planning. So if you are unable to think about not just what you are planning, but why you plan that way, it's easy in retrospect to look at Blockbuster Video and say, well, of course they should have bought Netflix in 2005. Oh, yeah. But in 2005, they didn't know. None of us knew. If any of us did know, we would have invested in Netflix. The point is you can look 2020 and say these things, of course, they're obvious because they become crystallized and linear in retrospect.
Yeah.
But in a complex dynamic system, in any system that's complex, emergence and nonlinearity are hallmarks of us not knowing what's happening tomorrow. In February of this year, none of us thought we'd be doing a podcast in this COVID era. None of us. But here we are. Yeah. Here all of us are. And so what's going to happen next year? What's going to happen next year? So yeah, if we are not.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm reminded when you talk about like Blockbuster, my first thoughts are like, I think there's a significant survivorship bias there, right? It's like, we all know in retrospect now that Netflix was the one that was going to win because they are the one that won. But I'm reading through James Carse's book, Finite and Infinite Games. And I love how he talks about in Infinite Games, we have to remain open to the idea that the past will surprise us rather than the future. So the past will reveal itself in new ways, as opposed to what we tend to do, which is think of it as it's a foregone conclusion. It is, you know, this is just reality having played out the way that reality was going to play out, as opposed to just acknowledging that there's significant amounts about the past that we still don't really understand. But what we like to do is we like to say, these are the primary factors that caused the past to turn out the way that it did. And then we end up oversimplifying. And in that way, I think we talked about this a lot in the SOC 1440 course. In that way, we tend to think of the past as a simple system when it's in fact significantly more complex than we give it credit for. And by painting the past as simple, what we're doing is we're reassuring ourselves that the future, it's also simple. If we just get the big pieces correct, we'll be able to predict the future. And as a result, we end up always thinking of the past as simple, as a foregone conclusion, and always thinking of the future wrong, and thus being unable to really anticipate how agile we're really going to have to be.
Absolutely.
So Ben's going to drop a Carl White guy's wisdom on you right now.
Yeah, you know, I was gonna. So we use Dr. Carl Weick a lot in design, and so if you take social paradigm theory, which it came in the 1970s, and it's building upon the original Kuhnian natural science paradigm shift. Now, the difference here, though, just very quickly, is that a natural science paradigm shift is when you take a previous paradigm that's no longer working, such as Newtonian physics, and so we're looking at the stars, we're looking at all these things, and the physics just aren't working. And so Einstein's theory of relativity as a paradigm has replaced it. Now, here on Earth, when you're driving your vehicle to and from work, you're still going to use Newtonian physics, even though it's technically wrong, because it just metaphorically is a useful heuristic aid for us to get around. You can't think in relativity at this scale. But if you're doing anything at a large scale, you absolutely cannot use Newtonian physics. So essentially, the Kuhnian shift occurs there. In social paradigm theory, though, they recognize that there are different groups of people around the world that are radically looking at the same exact things in the world differently because of social beliefs, values, assumptions, ideology, philosophy. We get into the fancy isms. And so how do these things, they compete together? So we have to think about different paradigms. So Carl Weick provides an interpretivist paradigm approach on how we look at history and how we look at the future. What I mean by that is he's arguing from a position that there isn't this analytic, optimized, measurable, structured, uniform, universal way that humans experience reality. It's actually very soupy and fluid, and we have to look for patterns. And so he says, most of the time we believe, and this is that rigid way, that we remember the past so that we can imagine the future. And he says, no, it's reversed. We actually imagine the past so we can remind ourselves how the future is supposed to go according to our institutional frames. And that is how we end up with organizations expecting tomorrow to be just like yesterday. And when it doesn't happen, we just fire somebody and we tell the next person, hey, make it like yesterday and do it better than the last guy. Instead of us thinking, why do we do it that way? And when you take Netflix versus Blockbuster, Blockbuster was looking more towards their history of how tangible, physical, geolocated entertainment was moved versus this digital, cyber, virtual context that just, it wasn't quite there yet. It was still new back in 2005, but it was too big of a leap. And so there you have it. That's one way of looking at it. Once again, 2020 hindsight. The question today is, with the things that are emerging right now that are just not quite everyday items yet, but we know they're important, 3D printers, reliable commercial space travel, looking at bitcoins and blockchains and these types of things. So they're there, but they're not really dominant yet. How are they going to transform reality for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to fight every urge to go deeper down this rabbit hole because we are quickly approaching the end of our time. And I promised myself I would make sure we were grounded in applications. So outside of the realm of these, you know, the adjacent possible of the, you know, the realms of current technology, of current science, let's talk about at the unit level, because I know that you all are dealing a lot with strategy and you're dealing, you know, at a very high level, but I'm curious for our, you know, our audience members who aren't dealing with high level strategy, who might be dealing with what is my flight or what is my unit, or maybe what is my group or wing? What are we dealing with right now? And those are, you know, Air Force terms, but we cross a lot of branches as well as government offices. Within just an office with a you know, line of practice, how would you say it would be best to put those principles of, rather than remembering the future, actually anticipating its complexity? What are the concrete steps that you would suggest, you know, besides start jumping into classes at JSOW, which I would highly recommend as well?
I'll take a swing at it, but the first, I got to throw two things out there real quick. First, the number one recommendation would be to get yourself involved with Agitare as a community of practice, because, you know, Daniel, I love what you're doing. I love the passion that you're bringing to the game. I love, you know, the courage that shows up in your writing, just your get after it-ness and the amount that you believe in facilitation as a DoD capacity in the wings. Like, I love that. I love everything about it.
So, I appreciate that, really. Yeah. I always forget to pitch my own nonsense, so it helps when other people do.
Well, I mean, it's just, it caught my eye, and it's, you know, I look forward to tracking, you know, the hashtag on LinkedIn and seeing what y'all are up to all the time, right? It's something that I want to be a part of because you're building momentum, and it's something I believe in. So, facilitation as a core competency isn't yet a thing, I don't think, in DoD, but we can make it a thing. Sure. And what, you know, what you're talking about at the group or kind of unit level, you know, I think it can show up in those ways, right? Like whether it's just individuals who want to get better at running meetings. Okay, great. That's facilitation, and it's useful, and it's super practical, and it's as ground level as it gets, because everybody has to go to meetings that suck. And just some basic level training and facilitation skills can make meetings suck less. And if you get better at it, you realize some percentage of those people are going to be like, wow, this is really awesome. I love making meetings suck less. I might want to do this as a career, right? And so all these doors start to open, and you realize that you can help people effectively. Like, what you're doing at the end of the day is you're just helping people coordinate and organize their thinking and their cognitive faculties in order to be able to move the needle on issues that they care about. So it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about a product level at a small group or a strategy level. Like, you're doing the same stuff, right? It's like, what kind of a problem or problems plural are we up against? Are these planning problems? Are these doing problems that we're just ignoring? Are these invention problems that really require new thinking? And then let's look at our approaches. You know, have we just not done enough due diligence on this thing in the sense that the solution sets are out there? We just need to Google them? Or is it something that we need to adapt from a different context and move those insights into what we're doing, right? Do we just need to take agile principles and make our workforce more sort of agile in the way that we do business? Okay, great. Let's do that. Or do we need like fundamental Kuhnian paradigm shifting, brand new ways of thinking about systems, you know, that affect us?
I love what you're getting at here, which is one of the foundational sort of principles of Agitare, which is, I think about, you know, what is recommended in a design context, or what would for example, in the Kinevan framework, what's the recommendation for operating in complexity? And the massive scale bureaucracy of the Department of Defense is a perfect example of, you know, cultural and organizational complexity. You got a bunch of different human systems all operating in kind of different ways, but aligned to extremely rigid frameworks, like way too many constraints for the amount of complexity that we're facing on any given day. And my thought and the recommendation is always you analyze what is in the adjacent possible, right? You get an idea of what the actual problem space is, and then you run a bunch of safe to fail experiments in parallel. And what I see mostly with, you know, is right now is you have some organizations that are attempting things at a couple of different levels. And my thought was, what if those parallel safe to fail experiments were just one facilitator in hundreds of different organizations trying different things and see what works? And I love the idea of the meeting. What if we just do the meeting differently? Because that is an example of just applying principles of design to something that is way easier to wrap our heads around, because it is a complex human environment. We're dealing with complex, you know, with social, you know, complexity there, with people's agendas, and we're trying to get something accomplished. But I love that, like, just let's just take a small bite out of these, of thousands of different, you know, ways that we try and get after problems and see what works and then scale from there.
Well, I think that, so before I jump over to Ben, let me just throw one thing out there. The other nice aspect of starting with the meetings, it's a relatively low risk thing, right? Like if you try a facilitation technique in a weekly meeting and it flops, hey, no big deal, right? Versus trying to run your first design sprint without experience, like failure there could not only set you back, but that organization may be less likely to buy into a deliberate creative process or a design initiative moving forward, because they're going to be like, yeah, you remember when Timmy tried that out a couple months ago? Yeah, we're not doing that again. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
I think, to be full disclosure, I probably facilitated it maybe like around workshop number 100. Did I really start to feel like I had any actual command of what was happening, to where I wasn't like, sweating through an undershirt every morning before the thing, you know what I mean? Like it really takes reps.
Yeah. And if I could just like bounce off of that really quick, the fact that it takes reps, I think is due to, that you're not like, I think that sometimes some of these methods that say just plug in a framework and it's so easy, it'll turn out great. It sets people up for failure. You know, this minimum effective dose thing. I love the concept, and it's very close to what I'm recommending with facilitating meetings, right? You have to do it in a context where it's safe to fail until you get to a level where you are capable of navigating much, much more, you know, complex, much more difficult scenarios, or you're dealing with people who have a much bigger stake in what the outcome is, right? Because when you apply these, my experience has been, you know, and I tend to do these just, all right, you guys are all getting together, I can help you make that conversation more effective. I can help you make it move forward in a way, or I can make sure you don't move forward before you're ready to, right? I'll make sure you hang out in the problem space for a little longer just by facilitating this conversation. And my experience has been that even when I plug in a framework, the outcome is always different. So I have to understand what that's supposed to feel like when it's going properly, and what it's supposed to look like and feel like when it's not. Because if it's not, it's dangerous to just go, well, that's probably good enough, and then move on. Ben, I'm going to kick it over to you now for your your thoughts in these final minutes on let's talk about what happens for people across the community and how they can get involved and, you know, start on their journey of becoming practitioners of this stuff.
So one of the things that we get asked all the time from senior leaders in the military, at the flag officer level, general officer level, they say, look, I don't need to learn how to do design. I'm leading my organization. I need you to tell me, how do I get it in my organization? Do I hire people? Do I send them the training? How do I do this? And so I'll give you a quick example, but I'll set up some framework here. And I can use an Air Force example. I was happy to say I went to ACSC as a major, so I was the token Army guy in there, learning how to eat popcorn with jalapeno and cracking open beers at a very early time of the day.
We're not so privileged as to have jalapeno in our popcorn.
You're not. Oh, you just get the popcorn. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know it's not that bad. So, all right. So here are the ground rules for any organization that's really trying to do this. Number one, and I hate using this term because it's used terribly today, but we need a safe space for experimentation. But safe space really means that leader, that sponsor, that design sponsor has to create a location, a time out of the battle rhythm, and an ability for it to link back into the regular practices of the organization so that that little cell doesn't get attacked or ostracized or hated. And that can very easily happen in our military. And the second thing that leader needs to do is put the right diversity of intellect into that group. And so normally people will say, well, I'm just going to stack all my best performers in there. Well, you put all your best planners in there, you're going to get a really good plan, but you're not going to get any design. Yeah. I would say that, you know, diversity of intellect for me is taking, if you're going to take the three airmen of the quarter, you better add in there three airmen from last month's blotter report as well. Because yeah. I want different people that think differently. And some of the people that perform poorly in our military gets rid of them. Sometimes it's for mm-hmm. justified reasons, but a lot of times it's because they just don't think the right way. They don't fit in. And most of you have seen that at a junior level where lieutenants and airmen get booted because they just didn't click because they were thinking so differently. And that's exactly the type of people that you could maximize to provide that diversity of intellect if you don't lose them first. Third, you need to have strategic sponsor or senior design sponsor support and protection. So that leader, that commander, that command team needs to protect this organization and engage with them. That means coming in, not receiving a briefing, but sitting down for an hour, clearing their calendar, and getting up on the whiteboard and rolling up their sleeves and listening, not giving guidance. This is where mission command really doesn't work in how it's normally applied in the military. And then lastly on here, failure in the design cell. Failure is much more important than almost anything else, provided that failure is built upon reflective practice. And so that team, they get rid of problem solution. That goes out the window because that's a planning mindset. We also get rid of end states and risk reduction. These types of concepts are part of the way we structure our planning. And instead, you're dealing with design, which is shattering and deconstructing what you currently have in order to consider what you're not thinking about and then provide that as your groundwork for experimentation. So here's an air power example. In the way back time machine, we go back to the interwar period between World War I and World War II. And at this point, air power is really taking off. And so companies are able to build advanced air fighters almost every year where they were just figuring out these new things and they were rushing them to the militaries that were buying them up. And so these air forces and air corps, Army Air Corps, they're just buying them up like hotcakes going, hey, this one goes faster than the last one. Give me 20 of those right now. And so they're coming off the assembly line with the engineer saying, well, we think that the planes can do this and they can fly this way and they have these capabilities, and they give them the manuals. This one British aviation unit said, you know what? We don't think the engineers that built these planes know exactly what they built. And so they designated one plane for every batch that they would acquire of a different model. All the other planes, they kept everything and they told them, learn how to fly it by the book, do it the right way. But then they told their pilots, this one plane over here, they stripped out all the control labels. They threw the book out. And they said, we want you to take this plane up in the air and want you to break all the rules. See what this thing can do beyond and outside of the engineer's own expectations of what this plane is supposed to do. Now, don't kill yourself, but break all the rules, because we think that if you can figure out something that this plane can do that even the engineers didn't intend or didn't realize, that will provide us a new advantage that no one reading the book will ever discover. So that's a very tactical example and a very dangerous one too, actually. But that provides that metaphoric device that we're looking at on, can you create a safe environment? And the airplane is a little shaky on that one, but bear with me.
Yeah.
But all those other things, it ticks the box on, can you allow your organization to experiment, to reflect, to critically think, and then creatively explore that which is normally gets slapped on the hand for even considering.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah, one of the, yeah, no, and I love that analogy. And I love also the acknowledgement of sometimes this required, it really requires an acceptance of the idea that innovation doesn't come from a system that can be made efficient. Yes. I think that there are ways that we can de-risk by, for, you know, and that's what you see in sort of agile development practices, right? Is de-risking is to lower the amount of investment required to learn and figure out what potential pathways might produce, you know, the intended value or the or unanticipated value. But I think the unanticipated there is a key aspect. It's that you can't really and I wrote a piece on this short time ago about this analogy of wandering downhill, because sometimes in order to find pathways to higher peaks with your mountain climbing, you actually have to go downhill, you know, sometimes a significant way before you can actually reach. I got that from a book by Andreas Wagner called Life Finds a Way. And it was about the methods of evolution. There's natural selection, which can only increase a thing's fitness on a fitness landscape. And so it'll get things trapped on these low peaks and they can't go any higher. And then there are other things which are intended to knock it off of those low peaks so that they have a new way of traveling upwards. So I think that what you're talking about, creating those cells and those spaces, is a key aspect for innovation strategy. Is creating environments and people whose role it is to engage in potentially inefficient processes.
Reminds me of, I was listening to Astro Teller. I think he was being interviewed by Tim Ferriss one time, and he was talking about kind of the environment that they set at Google X in the Moonshot Factory. And it's like, you know, it's just, it's a bunch of smart people running around with t-shirts that say safety third on them, right? as opposed to, you know, a sign on the wall that says it's been X number of days or years or whatever since somebody got hurt. Like, yeah, you never want people to get hurt. But if you're optimizing for nothing new or different to happen, like, that's what you're going to get, versus what Ben is describing, which is, you know, can you create the conditions for experimentation to occur?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And lastly, just the last metaphor we throw at the senior leaders is, most of the time, they're the example of the orchestra pit is what resonates with military organizations and large companies that are very good at reducing risk and doing repetitive things uniformly. So none of us want to go to a performance of a, you know, a symphony or whatever it is. You want to hear the music the way it's supposed to be done. You don't want somebody just doing their own thing in the violin section, or somebody not following the notes, or someone decides to be creative tonight and just sing it a cappella. It's like, no, I'm spending money. Pick your favorite band. When you go to the rock concert, you don't want them reading poetry. You want to hear the music the way it's supposed to be done. So that's planning. And when planning is done right, it provides that result. And we are consumers of that, whether we're buying it for commerce or we're consuming it for national security. But what we also talk about is that the leader has to leave the orchestra pit, walk across the street to the jazz cafe, and it's improv night. And it's either improv comedians, you know, riffing off of each other, or it's a improv rap battle, or it's a couple of people sitting around a guitar, a piano, and a saxophone. And there is no sheet music. And they're just experimenting over and over, and they're following each other's riffs, and they're trying different things. And 90% of it probably doesn't sound that great, especially the improv comedy. But when you hear that golden thing, that new thing, that this is that new sound you've been looking for, which is a Marvin Berry, Chuck Berry's cousin, that is what then the leader takes back across the street to write new sheet music so the orchestra can play the new sound that brings many more people that then you can get much more effective and productive at. The balance between those is what we don't really teach, neither in our professional military education or even in business school. It's not there. It's this artistry and science, and it has to be kind of balanced in this affinity loop. But we tend to have leaders that are much more comfortable on the regimented science side, and that's generally what our organizations tend to reward over and over until they reach a certain level, and then they're told, oh, no, you're a change agent now. Mm-hmm. But there's no book for that.
Yeah, I'm reminded of, just on the subject of music, just all of the times that I've read these sources for creativity books, it brought up that the most famous and the most successful innovators in art and music also tend to be the most prolific. Like, they create such a significant amount of work that they kind of, you know, like, through that much experimentation, it's kind of course they're going to come across innovative and, you know, like, groundbreaking stuff, because they just created so much of it. And that's something that I think, you know, we tend to have in our heads, that the greatest artists and the greatest creators have like this natural talent. I think that Malcolm Gladwell did an episode what's it called? Revisionist History on this, where he talks about, there are the occasional artists who, like, they just create like a very small number of works and they blow up. But for the most part, the ones who really do all the breakthroughs are the ones who just kept making stuff. And they're like, well, that didn't work. Let's start over and keep going. And it's all about that iterative, generative thing. And I think we tend to think too much in terms of genius and less in terms of mad scientist, right? Or just experimenter with a lot of failed attempts before they got to the thing that worked.
Let me throw on top of that real quick. Shakespeare wrote a whole bunch of bad plays. Hemingway has dozens of alternative endings to For Whom the Bell Tolls. Like, Mozart has terrible music. But you're right, it's the sheer volume produces a few golden nuggets, which we then celebrate so much because they knocked it out of the park. Right? Go to sports. Babe Ruth, I ran the numbers on this one time. He led the league in strikeouts and in home runs on several of the years that he was playing, right? So he was like, depending on what metric you're looking at, you know, measures of performance, measures of effectiveness, you know, that debate. He was swinging for the fences and he was striking out more than anybody else, but that's how he's hitting the long ball too, right? So what do you want? To Ben's point about how you're managing the dynamic between experimentation versus management and optimization in your organization, right? And then the last thing I'll throw out there, it's going back to that whole ivory tower discussion and bridging academia versus practice. There are two pioneering researchers in the creativity research community. One is Dr. Joy Paul Guilford, J.P. Guilford. He's a statistician, and he's the one who wrote that and delivered that landmark APA, American Psychological Address, in September of 1949, where everyone is expecting him to deliver this kind of a new statistical formula or a new way of looking at information data, like a quantitative presentation. But instead, he spent almost the entire APA address talking about the shortcomings of the psychological research community in terms of the ways in which they were thinking about creativity. And he said, we have to figure this creativity thing out. It has no operational definition. We don't know if it's teachable. We don't know if it's learnable. But it's a competitive advantage at a national level, so we have to figure this thing out, right? So he throws down the gauntlet in 49, and turns out, ends up working for the Army and becomes a director of psychological research in the 40s and 50s. So you can have a hybrid career where you're working in academia and in the applied side of the house as well, to tighten up those feedback loops, to make sure that you're stress testing your theories and refining and evolving them faster. And then the second person I'll throw out there is Dr. Ellis E. Paul Torrance. So Ellis Paul Torrance is an educational psychologist working at the University of Georgia in their College of Education for a really long time, just a prolific writer, wrote like an ungodly number of books and articles and chapters and whatnot, even more than Dr. Ben Zweibelson. But this guy, Torrance actually led a hybrid career as well, and he was one of the pioneering contributors to the SEER school and SEER programming, teaching downed pilots how to survive. So he was teaching applied creativity theory in an incredibly important context to the U.S. Armed Services, right? Yeah. So it's, I think, one of the ways in which you can bridge that gap is to connect with those hybrid practitioners, right? Those hybrid career folks, who aren't just sitting back on their, you know, the paper that got them tenure and riding that out, but instead are interested in constantly reimagining and sort of entertaining the idea in which they could have been wrong their whole career. Like, they're open-minded to how else it might be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I, as tempted as I am to stretch this thing into hour two, I feel like we are going to have to call it quits at this point. This has been just a wide ranging and fantastic conversation. And I want to thank both of you for joining me and for, you know, being open to me, joining the, JSAO course 1440, I think the Fundamentals of Design, which I thoroughly enjoyed and would highly recommend to anybody who's interested in kind of the theory and getting into the mindsets, behind this realm of fostering creativity, of figuring out how to better scope questions, of asking the right questions. And so, you know, I'm sure that I would like to have you on this program again sometime. I do not have a set schedule for it. It is entirely by accident that I ended up starting another podcast, you know, like 2 months after I swore I would never have a podcast. Now I've got one that I dropped and I'm on two. So, you know, it will be so long as it feels like it will be useful. And I'm going to kind of let that emerge as it will. But I'm sure that this episode will be enlightening for a wide audience. So any last thoughts before we go?
Well, yeah, just really quick. Thanks for having us. And we love doing these podcasts. I would say that for your viewers, if they're interested in other military design content online, so the Air Force has the Over the Horizon online journal, which has podcast articles. And if you go into their search engine and type design, you're going to have a lot of stuff come up because they've been publishing some great stuff. Secondly, if you go to YouTube, there is the Think JSAO, so JSOU, Think JSAO channel, which we upload podcasts, videos, lectures, all kinds of things. There's a great 14-minute military design 101 for those that just want a quick down and dirty on design. Then lastly, I didn't come up with this website name, but this is what they named it. there's the Archipelago of Design, and their actual web address is www.militaryepistemology.com. All right, so you're gonna have to just Google that one. But I'm telling you, if you can get to the website, Archipelago of Design, there's a ton of content from all over the world, all these military designers, as well as kind of the new emerging interplay between commercial hybrid types of design, you know, combining Scrum with Army design methodology, or Agile with systemic operational design. It's really, really cutting edge and weird, and we love it. So, Nate?
Yeah, I'll throw a couple out for your viewers as well. That one of my favorite ways, and in some ways this pushes back a little bit against what Ben was saying, in that I agree that you can't take a civilian design methodology and apply it in a military context, and you shouldn't take military design methods and drop them into commercial environments and expect them to work without some adaptation. At the same time, if you're looking for inspiration, I think it can be helpful to look outside of the context in which you are regularly swimming, so go find some new water to swim in a little bit. So for military folks who are interested in some civilian and academic opportunities, I'd encourage you to check out my favorite facilitation shop, without, like, bar none. I think the best people in the world who do this stuff is a small group of sort of creative, I can call them misfits because I think of them as my friends, but it's called No Innovation, KNOWinnovation.com. They specifically facilitate for like the National Science Foundation or the National Institute of Health or DARPA or like large federally funded problem sets. And they convene groups of like Nobel level scientists from different disciplines and then run them through creative processes in order to generate new disciplines of thinking. Like, they completely try to stretch everything they can in order to create new knowledge. And I think some of the insights that they post up on their blog and through their community of practice are just some of the best stuff that's out there. And then the nuts and bolts facilitation kind of mechanics stuff, like Facilitation 101, I think you got to be checking out what's called the Creative Education Foundation. They offer some free programming as well as a low cost, high value conference every year called the Creative Problem Solving Institute, CPSI. That's where, you know, there's like 400 or 500 creative process facilitators get together every week and spend a week in the dorm rooms at the University at Buffalo and like just try out all their new tools and techniques and stuff. So highly recommend if you want to go develop some facilitation shops. on the civilian side. And then obviously you've got like the Defense and Entrepreneur Forum, GovCity, Edutare, like all the things that are within the DoD, Defense Innovation Board, et cetera. Like those communities are also great opportunities to just dip your toe in the water and kind of see what feels right, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks again so much for being here. And I look forward to, you know, talking to you again very soon, I'm sure. I'm going to say that's it. I think it wouldn't be this show if I didn't not have a closer prepared. And so we're going to have to just kind of peter out awkwardly at the end. I didn't get to any of the questions that I prepared for you, but I didn't anticipate it. It's, you know, planning is everything, but plans are meaningless or something to that effect, right?
Thanks, Daniel.
So I'm
really
just
going to
go ahead and, yep. All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deaf.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deaf.org/join. That's deaf.org/join.